thanks for inviting me. And sorry for messing up the schedule even more. I just got a 16-hour delay in my flight. Okay, the delay was still shorter than the length of the flight, so. But finally, I'm here. So we'll give an introduction to Kolmogorov complexity, and then quick overview over some applications. The field is often called algorithmic information theory, and a specific quantity, Kolmogorov complexity, but these terms are sort of intermingled, but I think it would be good to separate, to call the field algorithmic information theory and the quantity Kolmogorov complexity. Okay, so first, well, this is a physics institute and sort of half physics workshop. I will present the Shannon entropy and the main properties, because then I want to compare them to Kolmogorov complexity. And there are strong relations between them and also, of course, differences. In order to do so, I will introduce prefix codes and Kraft inequality, then the concept of Turing machines and the version of prefix and monotone Turing machines, and especially universal ones. The Church-Turing thesis and a sharpened version of that, which is necessary. Then Kolmogorov complexity, a number of properties, and compare them to Shannon entropy, and then some of the problems of the measure. And in the second half of my talk, I will present how you can use Kolmogorov complexity, which I can state now is principally incomputable. So you can only approximate it in practice, but still it has quite some impressive applications in philosophy, in theoretical computer science, also in physics, and with approximations also then in practice. So feel free to interrupt me at any time. I don't have to present everything, and there's a natural break after the introduction, so maybe in half an hour or maybe 45 minutes. But you know, just raise your hand. Okay, so I assume that you have seen Shannon entropy before. So that's the definition of entropy here. That's, so I have some random variables x and y over some space x. I keep everything discrete, but first because, I mean, Kolmogorov complexity is defined over discrete spaces, and second, it makes things easy. Okay, so I have discrete random variable and a joint distribution over x and y, and also distribution over x, and the entropy is p of x log p of x and summed over all x with a minus, that's the entropy of x. And the conditional entropy is just the same with conditional distributions and then averaged over y. So that's the conditional entropy. And here are maybe the most important properties of Shannon entropy, or maybe I should say Shannon entropy measures the information content in random variables or in sequences, and I will talk about that later. So first you can upper bound the entropy of x by the size of the space. So if you have uniform distribution, this is maximum entropy, which is log x. And I talk mostly about binary strings. And if you have a string of length n, then the space has the size 2 to the n, so then the entropy would be n. So if I have a binary string of length n, the entropy is maximum for n. It's for a uniform coin flip. I mean, this is sort of trivial. So here, if the entropy of x and y is never smaller than the entropy of x, so you have more randomness if you have two random variables. And if you condition on y, the entropy cannot get larger, usually it gets smaller if you have extra information. Then you have sub-additivity. So if you have two independent random variables, x and y, the entropy of x jointly with y is the sum of entropy of x plus y. But if you have dependent random variables, you have this inequality. And you have a symmetry condition that the entropy of x and y can be written as the entropy of x given y plus the entropy of y. So it's sort of an extension of this sub-additivity. And then you can flip around x and y. So that's why it's called symmetry property. And the information non-increases. So if you transform a random variable with a deterministic function, you can never increase the entropy. You can only lose information. You cannot create information by a transformation. And at the end of the first part, I will present the same theorems again, and then you can see how they relate to Kolmogorov complexity. So I have to talk about prefix codes and Kraft inequality. Who knows Kraft inequality here? Okay, so half, okay. So, good. We say a string X, so X and Y and everything sort of from now on is binary strings, unless otherwise noted, finite binary strings. And a string X is called a prefix of Y. Well, if you can extend X to Y, and if the extension is non-empty, then it's a proper prefix of Y. And a set P is called prefix-free, or called a prefix-free code, if no element is a proper prefix of another. And one way to display prefix-free codes is, oh, I like blackboards. That's great. It's a new institute from 2000-something, and you have blackboards. Great.
Thank you.
Oh, that's fantastic. So if you look at this binary tree, and you go from top to bottom and only look at the leaf nodes, and so here we have the string 0, 0. Here we have the string 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0. Then we have 0, 1, 1. OK, I should have drawn maybe a smaller tree. OK, that's a disadvantage. Also, it's still better than to have the marker. And then 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, and 1, 1. You can easily see that's a prefix-free code. No string is a prefix of another because, you know, prefixes would be just a subpath, and if I only take the leaves, it gives a prefix-free code. So the leaves of a binary tree naturally correspond to a prefix-free code and vice versa. And Kraft inequality in one direction says the following. If I take the length of these strings, so this is length 2, 3, 3, 2, 2, and I take 2 to the minus the length, so these x's are in this, and I sum over all x in this set p, that's equal p, then this is bounded by 1. 1/4, 1/4, 1/4, 1/8, 1/8, so that is actually equal 1. So if you have a complete tree, then it's equal to 1, but this is also a prefix-free code, and then it sums up to less than 1. Okay, that's fine too. So that is rather trivial to show. The other direction is more interesting. So if I give a sequence of numbers, LK, and such that 2 to the minus LK summed over K is bounded by 1, then I can construct a code or a set such that it is prefix-free. And the most important application is the following. So if I have, say, x in some space x, so always finite or countable, and I have p of x, and I take minus log, all logs are binary, p of x, and I say, I define these numbers. So I start with a probability distribution, minus log p of x, and then make it an integer, then it is easy to see that 2 to the minus lx summed over all x. You just put that in. You have 2 to the minus minus log p of x, which is just p of x. And summing over the probability over all outcomes is just 1. But we have this upper seal here, so this gives less than 1. So this property is satisfied. Therefore, there exists a prefix-free code with these lengths as a binary code. Therefore, I can find a binary code for all strings x of this length. And that's known as Shannon-Fano coding, or Huffman coding. Yeah? So you can code a string x in this length. And that's the proof. So once you have Kraft inequality, the proof is trivial. OK. So next, what we need, we want to concatenate. So everything, you know, all objects, numbers, other objects, I want to code as binary strings. And then I want to have tuples of binary strings. So I need a prefix-free code. And that is sort of this little bit messy slide. So first I can biject natural numbers to binary strings. So here are the binary strings of length 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. Here are the natural numbers. And I can have this bijection here, which I can write, of course, in an easy expression for that. And that's not good enough for our purpose because I want to concatenate code. So I want to code number 2, which is would be the string 1, and maybe the number 5, which would be the string 10. But if I just write 110, right, I don't know how to decode it. It could be 1 and 10, or it could be 110. So I cannot decode that. But I can write a uniquely decodable code by using prefix codes. So what I can do is the simplest thing, the simplest version to make that prefix. So this is a string of length 2. So if I would know that the length is 2, I would know how to parse it. So I can write it like this. I take 2 ones and then a 0. And if I read from left to right, I read a 1 and a 1 and then a 0. That means a string of length 2 follows. So I read 2 more bits. And this indicator should only read 2 bits, and then is the end. And then I interpret this as 10, and 10 is 5. Okay. So if I use prefix codes, I can just concatenate them and uniquely decode them. And that is what is done here. So I take the number of ones, which is the length of the string, then a 0, and then this, by this bijection. And the code length doubles, plus 1 bit, which is good enough for many purposes, not good enough for all purposes. But you can do slightly better. So that is a unary code, right? So I mean, the number of ones gives me it corresponds to a natural number. But a unary code is very inefficient. I could use a binary code, but then I have the same problem: where does the binary code end? But I just take a binary code of this 1, 1, and then I take the first order prefix code. So I just sort of iterate that, and that is done here. So rather than specifying the length of this string, I specify the length of the string, and that is done in the second line here. The details don't really matter. The point is, what I can do is, so in the first line, if I take x as a natural number, and x sort of naively bijected as a binary string, so I mean here, I don't even have a symbol for, maybe I should make a tilde or something above it. Then the length of x tilde is just the logarithm of x plus minus 1, sort of, which I don't really care, okay? Plus minus 1. If I take the first order prefix code, the length of x bar would be 2 times log x plus 1 because it doubles in length, which is not good enough. And the second order prefix codes, which are marked with a tick, is only log x plus and then log x plus minus 1 and a 2.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then what we can do is if I have a pair of strings, I want to code them. I take the first one, I take a prefix code, the second order prefix code, the second one, or the last one, I can just take the plain code. Or if I triple, I just take the prefix code for x, the prefix code for y, and then for z. And the reason for the notation tick is it looks like a comma, right? So I could define a postfix comma operator, right, which works on the x, and I just interpret the comma as sort of the prefix coding. But that gets even more confusing, so that's the reason why I use upticks. So, but if I ever have a function and define it for only one variable, but then I use it for 2 variables, what I mean is that I code them together in this prefix form and then apply to. So if I define a function of 1 variable, but then I use it for 2 variables, what I mean with this comma, just put it up there. So this is a prefix code for x and for y, and then you can uniquely decode it. Okay. Yep.
But if you have like some coding of strings, how do you know whether you're coding a triple or you're coding a...
This I don't know. I have to know in advance. And if that ever is a problem, or so you have a variable number, then you would have to code at the first one the number. So this, you would, which has never happened sort of in my.
Or you put 18. Commas to everybody, right? Like an encoding of x and y, the pair could be x comma y comma. Could it be?
Yeah, you could do that too. But then you, so you still don't know then whether another string follows, right? So. So either you give a finite string, then you know where the end is, then it's not necessary to code the last one as x, or you deal, and that's the case and what I mostly deal with, you have only half infinite strings, so all infinite strings, and the rest is just dummy bits, and you have to figure out, or the algorithm has to figure out itself where the end is, then this is not sufficient. Even if you prefix code the last one, there still follows something, and is this something garbage, or is it sort of another code?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's some, you know, computer science notation that f of, no, actually it's not, so this is the standard here, the O1 notation, that means f of x is smaller than g of x apart from some additive constant, and I usually shorten that, I just put a plus on top because these order one terms will appear everywhere in my equations. So that means f is smaller than g plus some constant, independent of x. Okay. So next is, you probably all heard about universal Turing machines. And so you can enumerate, you know, Turing machines are abstract models of computation like a normal PC. And you can enumerate this Turing machine. So you just, you know, specify the table and the transition rules in some binary string, and you can enumerate all binary strings, and those binary strings which are not sort of valid codes for Turing machines just corresponds to Turing machines which do nothing. And so this slide is just about that you can effectively enumerate all Turing machines, which I will not, you know, show. And the partial recursive functions, so these are you know, computable functions, is the same as the set of functions computable with a Turing machine. And so we say that a set of objects S, and you know, if these objects are not numbers or strings, then we just code them somehow as numbers or strings, can be effectively enumerated if there exists a Turing machine which maps an integer I to then some coding of this OI. There, you can also say, you know, you can have a Turing machine which just enumerates prints O1, O2, O3, that is equivalent. So either you give an index for the set and it prints the element, or it just enumerates all the elements that's equivalent. Okay. So next is the Church-Turing thesis, which says that the class of algorithmically computable numerical functions in the intuitive sense, so what we can compute on paper, coincides with the class of functions which a Turing machine can compute, which are the same as the partial recursive function. So this latter statement can be proven, but the first cannot be proven because, I mean, what does intuitive sense mean? So this is the Church-Turing thesis, that the Turing machine captures everything which we can compute in the intuitive sense. Okay. So I need a slightly stronger version of that. So given two natural, and I come to that in a second, Turing equivalent formal systems, I think about Turing machines or, you know, PC or any computational device, F1, F2, then there always exists a single short program on F2 which is capable of interpreting all programs of F1. What that statement says is, so if you write a Lisp program, you can always convert it to a C program. You know, any other general programming language. And if these programming languages are natural, then these compilers should be short. And so for instance, I can define a programming language which has a command, print Wikipedia, and it prints, you know, all the billions of websites, or maybe there's only millions of websites, I don't know, of Wikipedia, all the content of Wikipedia, so print Wikipedia. And hidden in this sort of interpreter is all of Wikipedia. So that's not very natural, okay? And to convert this program, you know, print Wikipedia, which is just, you know, a couple of characters long, into a C program, it would be a very long program, print quotation mark and then a very long string. So the compiler would be long. So this thesis says if you have natural Turing equivalent systems, so natural programming languages or devices, then this conversion from one to other is easy. It's rather short. And while that's an informal statement, nobody knows exactly what natural is. So Markus Müller, here, organizer of this workshop, has a great paper trying to formalize, actually not what natural is, but coming up with a single unique definition of a universal Turing machine, which is the best approach I know of. It still failed, but it's definitely worth to read and see whether this can be fixed. So there's nothing really out there except for this work and some speculation. Okay. So I need, for defining Kolmogorov complexity, or the prefix version, which is sort of the most important one, a version of Turing machines which is called prefix Turing machines. Some of this is optional, and you could have different choices, and some of it is important. So I have a Turing machine now which has one unidirectional read-only input tape. I have one unidirectional write-only output tape. So I have an input tape where you read from, you have an output tape where you write to. You have some work tapes, internal ones. Everything is binary, no blank symbol, so just binary. That is very important. So I cannot have, you know, the input 001. It must be trailed by zeros, and somehow I must code the input in a way that I know where the end is. Okay? There's no blank symbol or term in comma symbol or something. And so we write the following. If the Turing machine T with input P, so P I often called program, although the program is also just a binary string, and if this Turing machine, if the input is P, holds and outputs X, I write T of P is equal to X. And what do I mean with, I said, you know, the input is infinitely long. So the Turing machine, I should draw this picture. So it has this input tape, has this output tape, has sort of the state tradition, has some internal tapes, that's important here, and has a head here and a head here. It operates, the head moves, can only move from left to right, and at some point it holds. Okay. And then what I say is assume it has something here, and here it wrote, it doesn't matter what is initially on the output tape because it's only write only. So it operates, input head and output head is here, then it moves here, 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 and then at some point it holds. Yeah. So what they say is that this Turing machine T on input 01 produced 011. Because it didn't read the rest, we can ignore it. Okay. So if P is to the left of the input head and X is to the left of the output head after T trials, then we say T of P of X. And the crucial point here is that if you look at all programs which produce a certain X, then this set forms a prefix-free code. Because, if it holds, at some point it holds, right? So, it cannot read more. It's rather easy. And we call these codes self-delimiting programs. There's a version of that which does not require halting, which will become important later. So if I toggle between, so it's nearly the same, except that we don't request that this Turing machine halts. So at any point in time, it still operates. We take a snapshot and we look at it. Okay, the head is now here, the input head and the output head is here, and then we write T of, in this case, 01 is equal to 011. And in order to distinguish it from the previous notation, I put a star here. So that means so far the Turing machine has read 01 and had produced 011, but it's still operating, possibly operating, producing more bits and reading more bits. Okay. And in this notion, for a fixed X, this set still forms a prefix-free code, but If you take the union over different x, it does not necessarily produce a prefix-free code. Simply write the Turing machine may continue and read the next bit, and then output 0011 whatever. Maybe it doesn't print anything out, right? It just reads another bit. Then we have this and this as the input. It is not prefix-free. Okay. So these programs are called minimal. But the first notion is much more important for general theory of algorithmic information. But for the induction problem, which I talk about, this notion is more important. Is that roughly clear? You don't need to understand all the technical details. The important thing is you have Turing machines, universal Turing machines, and you have these prefix notions where you just read and the heads move from left to right and you print from left to right. And either when the Turing machine holds, you interpret it as a function, or even if it's not holding, in the monotone case, you interpret it as some function. Yeah?
I didn't understand the last thing you said. Your example, you seem to show that P was not a prefix-free code. But your second last bullet point says that it is a prefix-free code.
For a given X, so if it prints another zero here, something like this could happen. Now we have, for given X, so now we have two different X's here, X here and X here. And for this X, we have this P here. So the set would be 0, 1, and 0, 1, 0, and possibly other elements. And that is not a prefix-free code.
Is there a mistake then on the second last line? Should it say forms, does not form a prefix-free code?
No, I wanted to show it is important for a given X. It forms a, so if I fix the X, if I just take a union over all X, it's not a prefix-free code, but this argument. So now I fix an X. It is true, the statement. So I say T computes a string starting with X on input P, formally written like this. If P is to the left of the input head, when the last bit of X is output. So what we have to do is, I didn't specify that precisely. So as soon as this bit is written, so as soon as X is completed, I have to look at the input head, look at this, and take this as my program P. I'm not allowed, and that was my mistake, to continue. I mean, I can continue, but say assume the head now moves from here to here. This is not, I will not put this string in my set. I will not put this in. So I have to put, as soon as X is produced, I have to look and take this input.
Okay.
Otherwise, it would also not form a prefix-free code. Thanks. I think I have to speed up. Okay, so what we can do now is, so I said you can enumerate all Turing machines. I do that, T1, T2, T3, that's enumeration of Turing machines. And so there's a universal Turing machine, like in the classical case, but also in the prefix case, where I want to simulate the Turing machine I on input Y. So I say on input Q. So Q is the program, I is the index. Forget the Y for a second. And if I just give this universal Turing machine the index I of this Turing machine and the input Q, then it simulates TI. And there's a good reason why I put extra side information in here. So I have here another input tape. So this tape sort of contains a program. This tape contains some other input, and I is the index of the Turing machine. Okay. So if you're confused, just forget about the Y here at the moment. Okay. If I want to simulate Turing machine I with input Q, I can do that with the universal Turing machine by specifying I and the input Q. And the Y is just another tape with some extra information. And The price we have to pay for this great existence of universal Turing machines is that you cannot solve the halting problem. That means there is no Turing machine which can decide whether another Turing machine halts or not in general. Okay. So Shannon entropy measures information, and Kolmogorov complexity does the same, but in a very different way. And the basic idea with Kolmogorov complexity is, so I have some data, some binary string, how much information is contained in there? So if it's just all ones, it's not much information in there. If it's, you know, maybe the digit of pi, it's a little bit more information. If it's some real data, some image, you can still compress the image, but, you know, there's some information in there. And the idea is we look at the data and we describe this data. And the more compact the description is, actually, the less information is in there. So if I have 1 billion ones, I can describe it as 1 billion ones. That's all there is. Yeah? If I have a digit of pi, then I have to describe what pi means or an algorithm, so it's more information. If I take a photo of you, it's much harder to describe. And but this depends on the description language. And so here we use Turing machines as description languages. So X is the data we want to describe. So we look for programs on a Turing machine which reproduce X. So if X is 1 million ones, this program is on some Turing machine very short. Okay? But there are many programs which describe our data. I could always write print quotation mark, just the data quotation mark. So we look for the shortest description on the Turing machine T. That's the minimum here, which describes my data. And that is the Kolmogorov complexity of X with respect to Turing machine T. Okay? But this measure depends on the Turing machine T. So it is, dependent on the notion of description, right? You know, you can describe something in English or in German, gives you different lengths. But what you can do is, so now it's a natural idea to use the universal Turing machine. So if you use the universal Turing machine for description, what you can show is that it leads to the shortest possible codes. So if I compare a description on a universal Turing machine to the description on any other Turing machine, it will be shorter apart from some slack. Because the universal Turing machine can simulate all other Turing machines, apart from having to additionally specify the index, which is in this constant here. So the best possible description of your data is a description on the universal Turing machine. And then you look, I mean, there are also many descriptions on a universal Turing machine, and you look for the shortest one. And you cannot have essentially any shorter code if you use any other descriptive effective mechanism. It will lead to longer codes, or at least not shorter codes, apart from an additive constant. Okay, what does these constants mean? What I mean is, if you have strings of, you know, of different lengths, this constant does not depend on the length of the string. Okay, and if I have a pair of universal Turing machines now, then Ku is smaller than Ku prime, apart from an additive slack, and Ku prime, because it's also universal, is smaller than Ku, apart from an additive slack. So what it shows is that if I change from one universal Turing machine to another, the code length changes at most by an additive constant. Okay? And so if you ignore this additive constants, and I guess Tom talked about that, that this is a problem, but I will argue it is not a problem, then you have a universal notion of complexity. Okay, that's the proof. So now let's just, you know, wrap up the definition here. So K of X, now I drop the index, I fix some reference universal Turing machine U, is defined as the shortest program on a universal Turing machine producing X. And the conditional complexity is the same, but just given extra side information Y. So it's a Turing universal Turing machine U, given Y and P producing X. That's the reason why I included Y previously. Okay. So if I have any other object, pairs of strings, natural numbers, whatever, I just code them somehow in a natural way as a binary string, and then apply Kolmogorov complexity to it, like here. So if I write k of x, y, what I mean is the prefix code of x and then y. Okay. So now come a long list of properties. So first, I can always describe a string by just print quotation mark, you know, and then the string quotation mark. So the Kolmogorov complexity is always bounded by the length of the string. Well, because it's a prefix-free coding, I need to specify somehow the, you know, the end of the string or a prefix code, so I get this 2 log L of X slack here. Okay. So that is an upper bound, a trivial upper bound. It's much harder in general to get lower bounds on Kolmogorov complexity. So here's a lower bound, because the programs which describe X form a prefix-free set, we have Kraft inequalities. That is just Kraft inequality applied to this prefix Turing machines and Kolmogorov complexity, which shows that K of X cannot be small for too many strings. So if I have too many strings which I could code shortly, then this would violate this inequality. It also shows that sort of you can only compress a small number of strings. In particular, it shows that the Kolmogorov complexity tends to infinity. Okay, these are rather trivial theorems. So now some less trivial theorems. So if I provide extra information, then the Kolmogorov complexity only shrinks because I can always use this program P which describes X. And if Y doesn't help, I just ignore Y, right? That's a valid program. Maybe there's a shorter program by exploiting Y, but I can always choose to ignore it. So providing extra information makes Kolmogorov complexity shorter. If I want to code two strings X and Y, it makes the problem never easier, usually harder. So we have these inequalities. Then we have subadditivity here. So if I jointly code X and Y and I don't care where X ends, then it's easier than if I care where it ends. Here, if I want to code X and Y, I can just first code X and then code Y given X. And together I have a code for X and Y, and this upper bounds K of XY. And this follows from up here. So here is the first really non-trivial theorem, the symmetry of information. Ignore for a while this extra K of Y. So you saw here that I can describe X and Y by first describing X and then Y given X. And you can show that describing X and Y in this way, you can do that in the same efficiency as here. So this is actually an equality. Okay? But the other bound in the other direction is highly non-trivial to prove. Okay? And it is indeed not exactly correct. So what you have to do is you have to also, in addition to giving y, you also have to give the Kolmogorov complexity of y. And you may think, okay, the k of y is just a function of y, but this is an incomputable function. So you cannot use this Turing machine hidden in this k to recover k of y from y, because it's an incomputable process. That's the reason why you have to give that extra. But by using this, you get this equality. Notice plus is always an additive constant. If you drop that, you get accuracy within logarithmic accuracy, which is often good enough. So you can drop that, and then you write a log in front of the on top of the equality. That's fine too. So that's a one-page proof, which is completely incomprehensible. Or you dig through half of Lee and Vitani book, which is 300 pages, and then you get a comprehensible proof. So I tried to sort of put it on one slide. But
which book, sorry?
Lee and Vitani, Introduction to Kolmogorov. That's the standard book. But you look for this theorem, and you trace back, and it's scattered over half of the book.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know.
And so that is, this is a complete proof for logarithmic accuracy, and not for the within order one. But as I said, it's incomprehensible. A computer can probably read it nicely. Okay, so here's information non-increase. So if I transform X, the Kolmogorov complexity can never increase, because I can just, if I want to code F of X, I just code X and then pipe it through F. And if F is a simple recursive function, in general, so if I have a code for F and a code for X, I have, of course, a code for F of X. And often, in these applications, F is a very simple function, so this is just an order one constant. Just want to remark, there are quite some subtleties in defining the Kolmogorov complex of functions, and there are various different ways to do that, and it's much more subtle than what I present here, but I don't want to go into that. So this is one of the most important bounds for induction and compression, which I call MDL bound. The Kolmogorov complex is bounded by minus log P of X plus K of P. So you know from Shannon-Fano coding that you can code X in minus log P of X bits if you know P, the distribution P. But the universal Turing machine doesn't know this P, so you have to give it P2. So if you give P, the probability distribution, to the UTM, and X, sorry, and if you give it P, and the Shannon-Fano code based on P, then it can reconstruct X.
Sorry, what is P?
P is some probability distribution over binary strings.
Okay.
Most of the time, this distribution can be semi-distribution, but some to less or equal than one, which there's a technical reason for doing that. Things usually go through. You can just think about there is some, the gap, the rest, the remaining probability is assigned to some object which you don't care. Or just think about it's equal to one. Okay, so, and those of you who have heard about the MDL principle, with the minimal description length principle, which has been designed to overcome the problem of the maximum likelihood principle, that it can lead to overcomplex models, which penalizes complex models. And the MDL principle minimizes the right-hand side. So you take minus log p of x. So if you minimize this, this is like maximizing p of x. So this is the maximum likelihood principle. But you penalize complex models here. Okay, and the idea is you want to approximate Kolmogorov. The best model for your data x is the shortest model or the simplest model. And most models are stochastic. So you can have a stochastic model, specify its complexity. And I will talk, if I have time, a little bit more later. And then you minimize the right-hand side, and you can actually show that this is a very good a way of dealing with the bias variance trade-off or the overfitting problem. Okay. So in general, proving upper bounds on Kolmogorov complexity is very easy. You construct some code, and then you and measure the length, and then you know that the shortest code must be shorter than this code. Proving lower bounds is very often very hard, and usually done by counting arguments. You know, there are at most 2 to the n strings of length n, then you have some pigeonhole principle, but these lower bounds are often very hard to come by. So here's a graph of Kolmogorov complexity. So I said I cannot compute Kolmogorov complexity, but I have an oracle in my cellar which computes the Hölting problem, and I just asked it to plot this function for you. So it's a very, very jagged function. So we have the upper bound log x log log x. So that's the upper bound. So x is now here a natural number. We have by Kraft inequality, if you look at Kraft inequality, you see that for most strings, the code must be larger than log x, right? The natural code is log x, so most strings must be larger. And you know, there's this very small gap here between log x plus 2 log log x and this. So most of your strings have Kolmogorov complexity in between, then some strings or some numbers have much lower Kolmogorov complexity, namely the simple ones. Yeah? So take the number 10 to the 10 to the 10. It has a simple description, so it drops down. You also have some form of continuity, very rough form. So if the number, if a number is simple, like 10 to the 10, then the neighboring number, 10 to the 10 minus 1 or plus 1, is also simple, right? I just add 1 or subtract 1. So you have a form of continuity. So if a very simple number, then the neighboring numbers are also simple. Of course, all with the additive one or the one slack. So that's roughly sort of how this function looked like. And so here is this slide again from the beginning with Shannon entropy. And you see we have exactly the same bounds. Yeah, we have the upper bound, which is log x. OK, we have a log log slack because of the prefix property. There are many different versions of Kolmogorov complexity. So there's also a plain version where you have log x without the log log x. But the prefix one is I think, the most useful one in most cases. We had this bound in Kolmogorov complexity, this bound, we had the symmetry bound, and we have the information non-increase. So you have exactly the same bounds from the structure. The differences are the following. In Kolmogorov complexity, you always have this additive constant as a slack, which you don't have in Shannon entropy, so that's a downside. But the advantage is you don't have to start with a probability distribution, right? And it works for individual strings. You just have a string, and you ask about what is the information content. If you have a domain which is rather unknown to you, coming up with these distributions is some guesswork, right? And That's a disadvantage of Shannon entropy. You always have to come up somehow with these probability distributions. Okay. Oh, okay. So.
Yeah, this is a 90 minutes.
Yes. Okay, so. I was asking for a sign 15
minutes before.
15?
We had 1 p.m. Like in
40 minutes. Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay. So I presented, so Kolmogorov complexity was based on prefix complexity. Monotone complexity is a version of Kolmogorov based on a monotone Turing machine. And this is tailored towards measuring the information content in streams, like, you know, the digit of pi, right? You don't really care about ending at 100. So you don't want to code, you know, what is the first 100 digits of pi, and it's 100 digits, you don't care, right? So what you have an infinite string, a potentially infinite string, and you ask, what is the information content in the first 100 bits? So I say, if x is the first 100 bits of pi, you want a program which produces this x and may run further. It doesn't need to stop. And that's called the Monotov complexity Km of x. Has similar properties. So here you don't have a log x slack because you don't have to code sort of the end of the string. It's called monotone because first it's based on monotone Turing machines, and second you have the nice monotonicity property. A longer string requires a longer code, which is not necessarily the case for standard Kolmogorov complexity. So if I have sort of, if I have 10,173 ones, you know, that's basically, it needs some code length. If I have, yeah, 1 million ones, that's easier to code. Yeah, just 1 million ones. That's a nice number. That's a crooked number. So the Kolmogorov complexity of this string is smaller than this string, although this is an extension of this. Okay. But with monotone complexity, this doesn't happen because, I mean, the Kolmogorov complexity of just, you know, 1 million ones or 10,000 ones, it doesn't really matter. It just have a program print one loop, right? It prints these number of ones and these number of ones. You don't care about how many.
Sorry, why is a million nicer than, can you repeat the argument?
Sorry?
Can you repeat the argument why a million is nicer than the other number?
Well, a million is 10 to the 6, right? So I can write 10 to the 6 in most programming languages, right? Which is much, well, it's not much shorter, right? So, I mean, you have always the additive slack, right? So I need to, so assume here I write a number sort of 7, 5, a really non-complicated number, and here I write just 10 to the 10 to the 10 or something like this, yeah? Then, you know, 4i equal 1 to 10 to the 10 to the 10 loop print 1 is a much shorter program than, you know, if I have to specify a very complicated number.
Space is dependent, but maybe that goes into that constant.
Sorry?
That seems to be basis dependent, however, this argument.
Well, you know, in
it does depend on the universal Turing machine in the sense that you're making an assumption that it somehow uses the decimal system to.
Yeah, but it depends, and you know, if you talk, so I mean, to be rigorous, you have to produce an infinite sequence sort of more and more complex numbers and an infinite sequence of simple numbers, and then you can compare it, and then it doesn't depend on the basis anymore. But for, you know, for any finite example, I can find a Turing machine which sort of violates this. I can, you know, the Kolmogorov complexity, as I said, of Wikipedia can be shorter than the Kolmogorov complexity of just all ones. Right? I can write a programming language, I can construct a programming language which prints out all the content of Wikipedia with just a single command, and I can write, and I can make it very hard for this programming language to print all ones. And then all ones is much more complicated than all the information is in Wikipedia, but that would be an unnatural Turing machine.
Yeah? Describing 10 short also on a binary Turing machine.
Yeah, I mean, I can convert easily binary to decimal.
Yeah.
Okay, but I think I need to hurry up. And here is the same MDL bound. Now, for if you have heard about arithmetic coding, which is the same, similar to Shannon coding, but for streams, so there's a similar bound here. Kolmogorov complexity is not computable, but it is not too bad. And here are some notions of computability. And so you have the finite, so I want to separate four notions of computability. One is finitely computable, so you really, after finite time, the Turing machine holds and produces an answer. So every ratchet number is finitely computable. Say you have a Turing machine which produces a numerator, Turing machine which produces a denominator, and you're done. What is also often called computable, which I, if I need to differentiate, called estimable, is, for instance, that pi is a computable number. But there is no algorithm which holds after finite time and produces pi because it's infinitely many digits. But you can specify the number of digits and the program which produces these number of digits. So you specify an accuracy epsilon, and then you run the Turing machine, and it holds after finite time and produces an epsilon accuracy. So f of x is the real valued function you want to compute, and phi is your is what the Turing machine computes, and it takes the input x, takes the specification, forget about the details of the epsilon, and after finite time it holds and produces an epsilon accuracy. That's usually also called computable. Sometimes I call it estimable to differentiate from this one. Then there's a weaker notion of lower semi-computable. So now we're talking about, again, real numbers. So if you can approximate a real number from below, we call it semi-computable, okay? Or a function, right? So there are functions which you can only approximate from below. And then there are functions where you may have an algorithm which converges, you know, closer and closer to the true value, but you never know how close you are. So it may oscillate up and down. And that is called approximable or limit computable. Okay? So that is sort of the weakest form of computability. In AI, it's often called anytime algorithm. So you have an algorithm, you can stop any time. But the longer you let it run, usually the better the solution gets. It can maybe temporarily get worse. If you run it sort of infinite time, it converges to the correct solution, but you never know how close you are and on which side you are. So these are the so-called anytime algorithms. If you can lower compute and upper compute a function, then you can estimate the function. So assume I have a lower, so I have a function here which I want to compute. I have a procedure which computes upper approximations and lower approximations. I just let them run both until they're epsilon close, and then I know my true function is in between. So if I have a lower computation procedure and upper computation procedure, then it is computable or estimable already. Okay. A limit computable is also this is delta one computable. So if you know about the arithmetic hierarchy, sigma one, sigma two, pi one, pi two, so this is in delta one, this is delta two, and this is sigma one. Okay. And what you can easily show is that Kolmogorov complexity is upper, semi-computable, but not finitely computable. So what you do is you just run all programs in parallel with some dovetailing mechanism. The first program first 10 programs for 10 time steps, the first 100 programs for 100 time steps, you run them. As soon as a program halts, you check whether the output is x. If it's x and the program is shorter than the previous best guess you had, you lower your estimate. You can approximate Kolmogorov complexity from above by this procedure. In this case, because Kolmogorov complexity is integer valued after finite time, actually, you arrive at the correct value. So there is an algorithm which after finite time gives you the correct answer, but this algorithm doesn't hold, and you never know whether this is the correct answer because there may be an even shorter program. Okay, so let me summarize. So the advantages of Shannon entropy is that it's computable. All the relations of all theorems are exact, but it's only about expected information, right? You need a probability distribution, and it talks about, you know, p of x, log p of x, the expectation of log x, only talks about expected information, and requires a true sampling distribution. Kolmogorov complexity, on the other hand, is information of individual strings. You have one string, nothing else, and you can specify under the assumption that you have started with a natural universal Turing machine. You can characterize the information of these individual strings, no sampling distribution required, captures all effective regularities. So if there's any computational regularity, Kolmogorov complexity will extract that. The disadvantages is that it's incomputable, you have an additive slack in most relations, and it depends on the choice of the universal Turing machine, okay? Which I said is acceptable for most practical applications, and I will come back to that in my second half of the talk. Okay, so that was the first half. It's too long. So are there any comments or questions? Yeah?
I'd like to understand a bit this notion of the last notion that you have in the list two slides ago. So a limit, no, one slide before. Yeah, no, one before. Thank you.
Yeah.
So a limit here is defined in the usual sense, right?
Yes.
So for all epsilon, there exists an n such that for all n prime larger than that n, this difference will be smaller than epsilon.
Yes.
Okay, the problem is that you can't tell the n.
So yes.
For epsilon, you can't tell the n.
Exactly.
Okay. Because otherwise, you would talk.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah, that's a problem. You can't tell the n. Okay. So then, come to the second talk, second half. Some applications. Okay. So I have slides for these applications, and I can talk briefly about some others, especially the Maxwell daemon and some others. Okay, let's just go through them. So this is much more, you know, scattered now. We had this, we had this. Okay. So if you know about, data compression, Shannon-Fano coding, these things, there's a very strong relation between probability distribution and code length. You can, by just taking logarithms, or from code lengths, you go to probabilities by exponentiating. And we can do that with Kolmogorov complexity too. Essentially, we exponentiate Kolmogorov complexity. And then we get a probability distribution, which is called M of X, and I should write about. So that's the basic idea. Okay. Let me skip that. So here's the more precise definition. Those are the correct ones, so this would not work. So what I do is the following. Now, I look for all programs which describe my data X, and I use here the monotone version, which is also important. And rather than taking the shortest program, so if I would take the shortest program here, rather than summing over all programs, if I take the shortest program, the length of the shortest program is by definition k of x. But I said I use the monotone version, which doesn't hold, so that would be km of x. And this actually is also a defined quantity and can be used for some things, but I don't know the symbol for that. But that's also not good enough for our purpose. So what we need to do is we need to sum over all descriptions. Yeah, okay. In a sense, it's an important technicality. You can just think about taking the shortest description of x, the monotone description, and taking 2 to the minus km of x, which is good enough conceptually. Okay. And so what can we do with this probability distribution? So we have also bounds on that. So first I take, take the logarithm of this equation, minus log m of x is about k m of x, and I define k capital M of x as this quantity, then you can sandwich minus log M of x between the Kolmogorov complex of given L of x and k of x, which shows that it is very close to the Kolmogorov complexity. Yeah, it's upper bounded by k of x and lower bounded k of x if you give the length of x. So it's within logarithmic accuracy, it's the same. But these differences become important for some applications, which I want to talk about now, namely induction. And that's the reason why I'm interested in Kolmogorov complexity. My work is in artificial intelligence and the induction problem, inferring from data general models, which are then used by this intelligent agent, is an important aspect. So let me skip all this and come to this equation. That's the only maybe proof I can present here. So once we have defined this M of X, we can define the probability. So this is a probability over strings. Okay? I haven't technically shown that it's a proper probability to measure, and actually it is not. It sums only to less than one, but as I mentioned, this doesn't cause any problems. So I can define the probability of X given Y as M of XY divided by M of X. That's just the standard definition of conditional probability. And in particular, I can ask, what is the probability of XT? Remember, these are all binary strings, given X1 up to, so T minus 1, which I usually write so as less T. So X1 up to ST, XT minus 1. So I look at this quantity. Of course, this is a probability distribution which comes from Kolmogorov community. There's nothing to do with reality, right? Just some probability distribution. Okay. So now, assume my world is deterministic, is some computable sequence. Okay, I don't know which. Okay, and I want to make predictions. So I see 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. What comes next? I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What comes next? I see 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 9, 2. What comes next? Okay. So let's assume we take this M for making. We cannot be certain, so we use M for making probabilistic predictions. So we look at the sequence x1, x2. We have seen the first t minus 1 bits. And look what M predicts. And compare this M to 1. We sum over all time instances t. So 1 minus M is bounded by minus log M. So 1 minus x is bounded by minus log x. So it's triviality. Next, now we have sum log m, so we can put the sum into the logarithm because it's a product. It's a logarithm of a product of conditional probability distribution, so we just use the chain rule, which gives the joint distribution. It's just infinitely often using base the definition of conditional probability. So technically, you have to sum to n and then take the limit and so on. So you get m of x1 to infinity. And now, if the string is computable, then next is we use this bound from before, so minus ln m, so this one here, minus log m was about Kolmogorov, the monotone complexity of m, and in this case we have a bound which is in the correct direction. This is a lateral logarithm, so we have a ln 2, which gives ln 2 times the monotone complexity, and the monotone complexity is the shortest program which produces in this case this infinite string, and a string is computable by definition if there's a finite program which produces it, right? So the digit of pi is computable because there's a finite program. So this quantity for a computable string is finite. So we have a finite bound on an infinite sum here of non-negative numbers. Therefore, m of xt given blah must converge to 1. So this quantity needs to converge to 0 for this infinite sum to be 1, and rather rapidly. So this bounds show that m of xt converges to 1. So what that means is, if you have data which comes from a computable process, you don't know which process, you use M for predicting, then eventually it will get closer and closer, it will assign probabilities closer and closer to 1 to the correct prediction. So whatever your process is, you can use M for making predictions. Whatever. You know, it can be stock market data, but in this case, deterministic data, okay? Apart from the previous talk, which denied the existence of objective probabilities, which I'm very sympathetic to, actually. But usually in practice, it is much more productive to assume that there exist objective probabilities, even if it's philosophically maybe not true. So assume now you have a stochastic process. Okay? You can generalize this theorem, and that is what Sonrol has done, and already many years ago. Where's this bound? Oh, I don't have this bound here. I cut it out because for time reasons. So you can generalize this also to stochastic sequences. So assume your data is drawn from some probability distribution x1 to t. So the probability of sampling x1, x2 up to t is mu of x1 up to t. Okay. So mu is unknown. And we use m for prediction. Then you can show that m of xt given x less t converges to mu of xt given x less t. Of course, you know, if I have a stochastic process, I cannot perfectly predict, right? If I have a Bernoulli 1/2 process, the best I can do is, oh, it looks like a Bernoulli 1/2 process. So if this process is Bernoulli 1/2, m will converge to 1/2. If you have weather data and you use m for prediction, it will converge to the true distribution, assuming weather is somehow stochastic. And what you can also show is that no other prediction scheme converges more rapidly to the true distribution. So it is, apart from always, you know, I don't mention that in every sentence, apart from this additive slacks, it's the best possible prediction scheme. So if you want to predict stock market data, the best you can do is use M. Of course, it doesn't guarantee that you predict correctly. So if nobody can predict well, then also M will fail. But if something predicts well, then M will predict at least as well as this.
So yeah? Notion of speed of convergence do you use?
You know Solomonov's. Maybe we take that offline. So, I mean, you know Solomonov's bound, that the sum is bound by Kolmogorov complexity, yeah. And you use any other measure, then this bound will become larger. It cannot become smaller.
But if I just take a mixture of all computable measures, it's going to be less computable than the Solomonov.
No, you don't get a better bound. We have a paper on that. Okay, but let's take this offline. Yes, yeah, but okay. So that was an application of Kolmogorov complexity to the induction problem. So if you have a problem where you don't know any structure, if you know it's a Markov process, you know, you use Markov predictors and so on. But if you don't know any structure, you use M. In theory, in practice, you can't. So you need some approximations. And actually here there are some approximations. So the problem is the incomputability, but you can resort to the MDL principle, which is in a sense an approximation, or Lempel's. So CTW is a very nice, you can regard it as approximation of Solomonov's distribution. Okay.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
Still, you have to suppose that the data come from a computable measure?
Yes.
Or a computable deterministic process, and then you would
use that. Yes, deterministic process or computable. Measure.
If you get, say, bits of omega, what happens?
Sorry?
If you get bits of omega number.
Yeah, then it fails. Yeah.
A question on the approximations. Yeah. You get them always from compression algorithms?
Yes and no. So if you look at most modern compression algorithms, they're actually based on predictors. So the CTW, for instance, is a prediction algorithm, and then they use arithmetic coding for compression. Yes, we get the most approximations from compression algorithms, but if you look at the compression algorithms, they are based on making good predictions and then converting them.
Would not be true for like Lempel-Sif or?
No, yeah, Lempel-Sif is not based on probabilities. That's directly a compression algorithm, but we can use that too. And I have some slides. So Lynn Bitani, 13 years ago, have used Lempel-Sif and other compressors, but also Lempel-Sif. Quite successfully for making predictions. In this case, not for sequences, but for clustering.
They're clustering by compression?
Yes, clustering by compression, yeah. Okay. Maybe very quickly. So the previous talk you heard about the question, what is probabilities? And the frequency context is limited, and you have subjective Bayesianism and objective Bayesianism. There is another way of treating randomness that's called Martin-Löf randomness. And the essential idea is, the idea of Martin-Löf was, so a sequence is random if it passes all reasonable randomness tests. So if I look at the sequence, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, it passes the test or equal numbers of zeros at once, but it doesn't pass the test equal numbers of pairs of digits. So if you apply all kinds of randomness tests, but you have to limit it somehow to effective tests, which you can execute on a computer, and then you have to weigh them somehow because there are infinitely many tests. And if a sequence passes all Martin-Löf, effective randomness tests, you declare it as random, and you can show that it is equal to incompressibility. So if a sequence is not compressible, so if the shortest program which describes the sequence is the length of the sequence, then this sequence is Martin-Löf random and passes all randomness tests. And There have been some experiments by Chris Kalud testing whether quantum, so comparing pseudo-random sequences, classical random processes like coin flipping, but something more mechanical, and true quantum random sequences, and comparing them in this framework and to try to determine whether they are really random. Just as a side remark. I think that's all I can say about Martin Löf randomness due to time. Okay. Maybe one comment. So if you look, you know, at the digits of pi or square root of 2, right, you maybe not start from the first one. You start from the, you know, 1 millionth digit and then look at the digits of pi and digits of 2. And you use the naive randomness test, you know, frequency of digits, pairs of digits, yeah. It's not proven yet, but they are most likely normal numbers. So all these randomness tests tell you this is true randomness. While, of course, you know, digits of pi is not really random. And Martin Löf randomness and Kolmogorov randomness, which is technically the same, go beyond that. And for the digit of pi, of course, Kolmogorov complex is very small, much smaller than the length of the sequence. So it shows you it is not random. Okay. So the MDL principle I mentioned already, so let me skip that. So that's a classical example. You have some data points, and you want to fit, you know, a polynomial through it. Of course, if you have a high-order polynomial, you can fit the data perfectly. Your other linear line, you know, it doesn't fit well. So the question is, what degree of the polynomial we should choose? And there are various forms of regularization. If you have a machine learning background, you see often, you know, the one-norm regularization, two-norm, but they're all parameters. But if you want to determine one parameter and you have one parameter to play with, you can get any answer. So you want, you know, a unique scheme. And here, if you apply the MDL principle derived from Kolmogorov complexity, you see that, again, for reasonable choices of your code length, you see that in this case, sort of a cubic polynomial is the best fit. Not the best fit of your data, it's the most reasonable model. Okay. And one thing what you have to, I mean, here are real numbers, right? These polynomials have real valued coefficients. So you have ax square plus bx plus c. And real numbers, you know, have infinite Kolmogorov complexity. What you have to do is you have to specify these coefficients to some finite accuracy, okay? And roughly speaking, you can show is if my sample size is n, I should code all my parameters to log n number of digits. Okay, so each parameter counts as log n in complexity. One half log n. Okay, Peter Grünwald and Chris Wallace have written two thick books, more or less, just about that.
Is that related to Kolmogorov sufficient statistics here?
Not really. Detailed answer after that, okay? yes, it is.
I thought that the red line, the rest is just...
Yeah.
So it's kind of the...
Yes, on an abstract level. It is more closely related to... yes and no. Okay, here I want to present some really impressive applications. So if you look at the conditional Kolmogorov complexity of x given y, so if x and y are similar, then there should be a short program which transforms y to x, and if x and y have nothing to do with each other, then you know you can just ignore y and you have to code x. So Kolmogorov complexity of x given y is a natural universal similarity measure between objects. And measuring similarity is not easy because, you know, if I have a metric space, you know, maybe the Euclidean norm is the right thing. If I have binary strings, maybe just count the number of different bits. But then, you know, if I have just a mirror string, right, mirrored around or bits flipped, it gives a large distance, although the content is really the same. So in Kolmogorov complexity, it's flexible enough. So if I can transform y into x in an easy way, then it will give me a small number. The disadvantages is it's not symmetric, it's not properly normalized, it's not computable, but you can fix all these problems. So what Lee and Vitani have done in a couple of papers, So first you symmetrize, and then you normalize for string length, otherwise you get a not good measure. And they called it the universal similarity metric, and you can show that it's actually a metric, so it satisfies the triangle inequality. Next step is to approximate that, and they just use standard data compressors like Lempel-SIP, G-SIP, and B-SIP to approximate Kolmogorov complexity, and then you get this expression here. So they are not conditional compressors, but we have this theorem that K of xy is the same as K of x and y minus K of y, and then you can write it in this form. So it just what you do is essentially you take a string x, compress it, you take a string y, compress it. Then you glue it together and you compress it. And if there's similarity between the strings, the joint compression should be much shorter than separate compression. And that is what is captured in this notion. And then if you have multiple objects, you just take all pairs. And they applied it to DNA sequences, which are based on ACGTs, or adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, or something like I forgot, yeah, of 24 mammals. And they get a huge similarity matrix. And from this matrix, you can compute a similarity tree. And here's the similarity tree. And if you look at this, this perfectly coincides with the biological phylogenetic tree by just using standard data compressors. And they really have no biological knowledge in there, which is pretty amazing. So you see all the monkeys here together. And this is Australian animals, and carp is not a mammal. They put it in, and you see it's very different from all, the genome is very different here. You see the whales are together, and where's the human? So humans are very close to chimpanzees and to gorillas, so which also makes sense. So so it just comes out of data compression, which is amazing. Then they did the same with languages. They took the Declaration of Human Rights in 60 or 50 languages and reconstructed nearly... Same algorithm, same compressor, nearly perfectly reconstructed the language tree. I think there are some two or three errors or so in there. Well, according to linguists' knowledge. So, okay. Okay, so this is what I'm working on. I also work on the induction part, but mostly I care about AI. In order to solve the AI problem, what I mean with that, you know, really developing agents which are super intelligent, you need to solve the induction, the prediction, the decision and action problem. So first the agent has some observations, it builds a model of the data, then it uses the model for predictions, and these predictions are then used for decision making, which then lead to actions. And that's a critical step, these actions influence the world, and you have a feedback loop, which makes things much more complicated. So this is this agent environment perspective. Then the question is, what is intelligent, right? You play chess, you just throw away the figures and walk away and make a million in the stock market, right? That may be more intelligent than winning a chess game. So it depends on your goal. And the goal is specified as rewards here. So it's the reinforcement learning scheme. So the agent performs some actions, the environment reacts back to these actions. You have a regular observation to the agent, or occasionally you reward the agent for its behavior. You know, you have done well, you have done poorly, and the agent tries to maximize the reward. If you want an autonomous agent, you can connect these rewards to, say, you know, the number of different rocks it has collected on Mars, and then it is a specific agent. If you want this agent to be nice to humans or useful, then you, as a teacher, should give the carrot and the stick to this agent. If you want a more universal notion of the agent, what we have done too, you could connect these rewards to information gain, then you get an agent who is maximally curious and tries to learn about the universe and figure out how it works. And while doing this, it has to, of course, you know, develop technology, space travel, and all these kinds of things. Then you get a very curious agent, which may just run over us because it doesn't care about us. Yeah? But I don't have time to talk about all these things. I just wanted to mention that this reinforcement learning scheme is a very flexible scheme for ranging from useful agents from particular tasks, useful agents generally for us humans, or completely autonomous agents if you clamp these rewards to, say, information gain or some other things, okay? And let me skip all this. Oh, no, I cut out even my favorite equation. Okay, so well, that is just the general agent environment framework, the question is, what is the most intelligent agent? And what you do is the following. So this agent collects rewards over its lifetime. The environment is stochastic, so it, you can define the expected reward sum over the lifetime of the agent, which is called the value of the agent in environment Q. So that's the value of agent pi in environment, okay, mu in this case if it's stochastic. We don't know mu, that's the important thing, like before in prediction. So what we do is we take a weighted average over all possible environments, and the question is, how do we do the weights? Well, by Occam's razor, we should have a priori higher belief in simple worlds and more complex belief, and lower belief in more complex worlds. So we use 2 to the minus the complexity of the world, average over that, and then you get a measure of performance of the agents averaged over a wide range of worlds. And then the most intelligent agent is to just take the argmax, and that's it. And you can show, and I've written a whole book and hundreds of papers about that. Well, meanwhile, it's hundreds of papers, yeah, that show that really this is the most intelligent agent. And I mean, I define what does it mean. I mean, intelligent, you know, is a vague concept and so on. Okay. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about this, or I have time to say about this. You can use notions of Kolmogorov complexity for universal search. Maybe the simplest example is you have 2 search procedures in AI. There's breadth-first search, for instance, and depth-first search, and you don't know which is better. Just run both in parallel with 50% computation time, and the first one, which holds, gives you the answer. And in the worst case, you're a factor of 2 slower than having chosen a priori the faster one, so you just lose a factor of 2. Okay? Who cares about a factor of 2? So you can push that to the extreme and just run all algorithms in parallel, giving the first algorithm maybe 50%, second 25%, and so on, and then look for the answers. If you run all algorithms, many algorithms produce garbage, so you have to verify the answer. That leads to Levin search. If verification of the answer is hard, which is true for many problems, you can use my fastest program for. So the title of the paper is the asymptotically fastest and shortest algorithm for all well-defined problems. And apart from some multiplicative constants, that's actually true. So it's a nice theoretical solution to sort of search problems in general. And Jürgen Schmidhuber has actually converted it to some real practical algorithms which solve some problems. Okay, so if you care about... well, okay, that's a miscellaneous slide. So I have a human knowledge compression prize. So if you can compress 100 megabyte of Wikipedia better than the current state of the art, you get a fraction of this 50,000 euros. So if you compress by 10%, you get 10% of this prize. So it's running now for 13 years and continues. And so I wanted to promote that there's a very close relation between compression and prediction and intelligence. And this is. Okay, so maybe I should talk about Maxwell Damon. So I guess most of you are physicists and you've heard of, you know, more about Maxwell Damon. Well, I was a physicist a long time ago. And the problem is that this Damon, right, if a Damon wants to work, right, knows whether these particles, you know, go from left to right. And so the standard notion, so that the agent, you know, needs to forget this bit, and the forgetting, you know, if you add that to the entropy, you solve the problem. But you can also store this information on a tape, and if you add the Kolmogorov complexity of these bits, which this daemon has acquired, to the classical notion of entropy in physics, and you add it together, then the second law of thermodynamics is also rescued. So you can nicely use Kolmogorov complexity solving Maxwell daemons. And there's also a notion called reversible computing. You know that for irreversible computing, you produce KB times something.
KT ln2,
yeah. Okay. Entropy and... at the moment, we're not at this limit with the chips, but at some point, this will become a problem, possibly. But you can avoid it by reversible computing. So the problem is, or the idea is that you just, you know, you have a gate, the AND gate is not reversible. You just add some extra output, which keeps the information. So you have here sort of X and Y, and here's your X and Y, and you just keep X and Y around. So now it's reversible. And you can do that without increasing the entropy. But you have to store all these bits. And you know that's a lot of bits. And the question is, what is the minimal number of bits you need to store in order for this to work? And you can use Kolmogorov complexity to show that it's actually very, very little. Yeah, it's more or less the length. So if you have, you know, you have lots of these gates, you have an input and an output, you just essentially have to keep the input around. And actually even only the Kolmogorov complexity of the input. I guess I stop here. Yeah.
I think there was Mike first. Right.
Mine's short anyway. Okay. I was just so the notions of randomness, like Martin of randomness, yeah. And so on. I've always been a little bit confused by the idea that you're talking about. So it's just a semantic question. So the idea that you're talking about the randomness of a string.
Yes.
Is it equally okay to think of it like as a string generated by a random process?
Well,
can you think of it that way, or is it problematic to think of it as a string?
Well, this direction is okay. So, if you have classical probability theory, you cannot ask the question: is this string random or not? The classical probability, right? You just have, you know, well, the string. Take the string 0, 0, 0. Is this string random? This question doesn't make sense in classical. You can assign the probability of this string. If you have a fair coin flip, it's 1/2 to the n, right? But the same for a more random looking string, yeah, is also 1/2 to the n. So you cannot ask the question. But in Martin-Löf randomness, you can ask the question, is this string random? No. Is this string random? Yes. But what you can show, for instance, that if you sample a string from a Bernoulli 1/2 process, then with probability converging to one, close to one, depending on the length of the string, right? This is a Martin-Löf random string. So there is, of course, some relation. So strings sampled from a distribution, most likely, but not for sure, of course, right? Most likely are Martin-Löf random.
I was wondering, in your opinion, what's the significance of this strong analogy between, on the one hand, properties of Bayesian probabilities encoded in Shannon entropy, yeah, for example, and the analogous equations for Kolmogorov complexity? You have this sort of very strong parallel, and I'm just curious what you think. You know, why do we have that strong parallel?
I think that's two questions. So the why question is maybe harder. The significance. Assume you have some problems where you need Shannon entropy and you solve it, or you try to address it somehow, and you run into problems where you don't know the distribution, or you just have sample size one or something like this. Then have a look at Kolmogorov complexity. And there's a whole industry in Moscow transforming, I mean, there are hundreds of theorems about Shannon entropy. I just presented sort of the basic ones, transforming all these theorems and showing equivalent versions in Kolmogorov complexity. So most likely, if you use some sophisticated Shannon entropy techniques, right, but your problem setup is not good, right? So you don't have IID data or you don't have sampling distribution, you can find analogous results, I mean, Kolmogorov complexity, and then use this. And maybe that helps you. For instance, in AI, if you think about an agent interacting with the world, you know, the world is not IID, yeah, even not, you know, stationary or something. You know, indeed, you know, as soon as you converge to a stationary scheme, it is boring, right? So, for an agent interacting with the world, I have sample size one. That's the past of the agent, or the last, you know, 3 years of the agent. That is what the agent has seen. Maybe there's some parts which were IID, but overall, the lifetime experience. It's just one lifetime experience, and therefore the notion of Shannon entropy is not particularly useful in this context. Why?
What's the foundational significance of these analogies is really what I'm asking. Like, I grant that I see the applications of not focusing on Chern entropy. It's more you have this similarity of mathematical structure.
Yeah, this probably comes from... it's really hard to tell because, I mean, the symmetry of algorithmic formation, right, is rather surprising that it holds. It is rather easy to show in Shannon entropy. And if you can easily mess that up. For instance, my Kolmogorov complex is not computable. We would like to have computable versions. There are computable versions called Levin complexity. But then all these beautiful theorems break down in the relation to Shannon entropy. So, I mean, for each individual result, I can probably, tell you why it is the same as Shannon entropy, but overall why it matches so well, I don't know. So for the symmetry of algorithm formation, that's probably the hardest to explain why it works. Any other questions or comments? Yeah?
Wouldn't it just come from the algebraic property of some sort of chain rule? You know, you have h of x, y equals h of x plus h of y given x.
Yeah, but
it
that...
It happens to be that it works also for...
Yeah, but that...
Once
that,
you have that, you kind of have everything, or...
Okay, maybe that's a good view. So once you have the symmetry of algorithmic formation, which is the thing which is hardest to explain and hardest to prove, then everything else follows, possibly, yeah?
One more question.
Yeah.
Time for
lunch before the probably has the answer.
Just a comment on Bob's question. Maybe it is surprising that Kolmogorov complexity has the properties of Shannon entropy, but it's not surprising that Shannon entropy has the properties of Kolmogorov complexity, because it's a special case.
In this direction it is more easy to see because, I mean, if you just define this probability distribution, but, I mean, then Shannon entropy works on all distributions and not just on this distribution.
I suggest that we continue the discussion over lunch so that those who want to go to the colloquium will still have time to comfortably lunch.
And one more application I will present on Thursday about theories of everything and observer localization, which is sort of more closely related to physics. So if you are here, you can attend that too.
Okay, so let's thank again Professor Huber for the
Thank you.